This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hello and welcome to the third edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club. My name is Edward Jones and I'm your host, and joining me as always is my co-host from Guido Ramblings and Eastern Kicks, is Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Thank you very much for having me yet again.
Obviously tonight we're on our third edition, and tonight's selection is chosen by Stephen, who has gone for the Thai movie, or the Thai Western, should we say, Tears of the Black Tiger. And the first of tonight's butchering of foreign names. This one's directed by Wisit Sassine Nanting.
I think it's Sanathat. Oh, crikey, I can't do it either. Sanathiang.
Yeah. Who also can be known as Sid. So, whichever one you want to go with there. But before we obviously get into our selection for the week, I mean, it's obviously keenly we address the current situation happening in the world. I mean, there's a lot of political discussion, there's a lot of heated debate about events happening in the world, and of course, like, the key topic that's been obviously the most discussion really since last episode, and that's the fact that Stephen, you've never heard of Kaiju Big Bad L.
I hadn't until we finished recording last time.
I mean, obviously, if you're like soon and have no idea what I'm talking about, Kaiju Big Battle is basically you get to go and watch wrestling, but instead of people in spandex, you get to see people dressed as kaiju monsters fighting in a ring with cardboard buildings in the ring, and they basically battle it out. And you've got colorful characters such as Chicken Noodle Soup and the Plantain Twins and the evil Dr. Cube. So, I mean, since we discussed it at the end of the last episode off air, I mean, did you have a chance to watch any more Kaiju Big Battle?
You kindly linked me to some YouTube videos.
Yeah.
And I did watch them.
Okay.
with a kind of mix of dumbfounded amusement and, you know what, that's kind of cool. With full geek cred on, you know what I mean? It's If you're gonna mash up two nerd cultures,
yeah,
wrestling and kaiju movies, you might as well do it full on, right?
Of course. I mean, obviously, at the moment, the company is going to be getting its first ever video game released through Super Warriors Games. The game that is called Kaiju Big Battle Fight or Fantasy, and it's kind of like a Final Fantasy style game. We did an interview with the designer of from Super Warriors Games over on my other podcast, Game Warp, and I will include a link at the bottom of the description there. And basically, from what they're saying, it's going to really tie in to what everyone loves about Kaiju Big Bad L, but put it on this world trekking mission and incorporate elements of Final Fantasy into it. So that is certainly something I'm still very excited to see. And since we obviously saw the trailer first appear on the Steam early release, and it's really exciting, all the screenshots that we keep seeing from it, because basically you get to see these like 16-bit versions of all your favorite Kaiju Big Battle wrestlers. So that's certainly what's been holding my interest. But I mean, other than obviously that, I mean, if you had anything holding your interest in the world of sort of Asian cinema or Asian TV at all?
Do you know what? It's actually been a bit of a fallow. It's been like a month, hasn't it, since we last recorded?
About that.
And in terms of Asian films, I think I've hit a bit of a dry patch, really.
Okay.
I have that towering pile of DVDs and things saved, but real life has kind of got in the way, and I haven't been feeling entirely inspired. However, I have just got hold of a whole bunch of female prisoner scorpion movies featuring one of my favourite Japanese actresses. So I suspect I will be diving into there and no doubt bringing it here at some point.
I mean, have you ever seen any of the female prisoner scorpion movies?
I saw the first one a very long time time ago.
Okay.
I can't pretend I'm totally blown away with it, but it was a long time ago. And I think I'm more interested in it now.
Yeah.
And of course they've got Mike Okaji in it, who's an idol for me. So I'll go back and I'll enjoy greatly, I hope.
Yeah. Mike Okaji, you nailed it on the head right there why would you want to watch female prison score? Mainly because Maijo Kaiji's in it. Let's not forget, she's not only did this series, she did the Stray Cat Rock series, she was in Lady Snowblood. And she's ranked up over about 100 film credits over the years. When you go through it, and it's basically any sort of key cult sort of Japanese film that's come out, you can pretty much guarantee she's in there somewhere. Just looking at the list here, we've obviously, she was in Blind Woman's Curse. We mentioned already Stray Cat Rock. She did, it was four films for those. It was like Delinquent Girl Boss, Wild Jumbo, Sex Hunter, and Machine Animal. She was in Yakuza Graveyard, and she was in both Lady Snowblood movies. She even turns up in Battles Without Honor and Humanity, Hiroshima Deathmatch as well. So she's a lady of whose career is definitely worth looking into, certainly. So if you've yet to obviously discover her work, then I would highly recommend that you go check it out. Have you seen much of her work, or is it sort of...
I love both Lady Snowblood movies.
Yeah.
I reviewed Blind Woman's Curse not that long ago on Guaylo Ramblings, and that's a very interesting film, sort of a mix of B movie and art movie, really, in some ways. But of course, she stands out. Of course, I know the Stray Cat Rock movies. Yeah, I've seen a lot of her stuff, but this is just sometimes I avoid the ones where there's like four, five, six, seven films. It's like I think when we spoke on the first episode, I just sort of started getting into the Lone Wolf and Cub films because there's this sort of this challenging oeuvre of movies that I don't, it's quite hard just to pick one or two. You feel obliged to watch the lot, and I find that somewhat intimidating at times.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, when we look at her career, though, it's easy to compare her career and the career of like Pam Grier. Well, Pam Grier's blaxploitation, I think that she really is to the girl gang movies, and certainly tough women in Japanese cinema. I think she's really sort of the embodiment of that, and it's a shame she never had that crossover appeal. And she was obviously given offers to do films in Hollywood, but it was her confidence to perform in English which she led to her sort of refusing them. And she started off at Nakatsu, and she did like the Stray Cat Rock series, and then when Nakatsu started going into like the pink film and the Roman porno sort of business, she moved over to Tori, and then we obviously saw like her doing like the female prisoner movies. And I go back and forth over which I prefer, whether I prefer like the female prisoner movies or the Stray Cat Rock series. But I know both have received really nice box set releases from Arrow. Frustratingly, both in like limited numbers, which means that if you don't order it when it comes out, you can expect to pay like double, maybe triple the price when you go to pick it up later.
Yeah, it's what it's all ones where they look on eBay and you think, oh my god.
Yeah.
Do I like it that much? And the answer is no.
Yeah, damn traders.
Indeed.
Obviously, onto our selection for this evening, you've chose Tears of the Black Tiger. This is unique in obviously being an Asian Western, or an Eastern Western, should we say? This was released in 2000, but what is it that appealed to you about Tears of the Black Tiger that made you want to obviously cover it on the show?
Well, I guess again, I think I've spoken about this before, but one of my driving influences about writing on Guaylo Ramblings in particular is to show people, yes, there are these genre films. Yeah, there are samurai movies. There are Kurosawa movies. There are kung fu movies. There are in Asian cinema, there are standard genres that are played upon. But occasionally you find something that's out there and different. So I actually write quite a lot at Eastern Kicks about Thai, more indie art house cinema. So sort of slow cinema and things like that. But this this has it just blew me away because it had a certain imagination and visual style. It's not saying that there aren't people like in South Korea, like Park Chan-wook, who has a visual style, or the craziness of someone like Takashi Miike, who we've spoken about before. But in Thai cinema, this is very unusual. Thai cinema is, although quite strong, is mostly known for pretty classy horror movies, impenetrable comedies, and a decent amount of action. But to find something that's, well, I'll probably talk about this a bit more later, but it's steeped in history and it's got a unique visual style that even if you don't like the film, I think you can't help but be impressed by.
It's certainly an original film, I'll give it that much. I mean, I have to admit, obviously, I've not a huge amount of experience with Thai cinema. Most of my sort of experience with Asian cinema has obviously been with like Hong Kong, Japanese, and Korean cinema. So it's obviously interesting the fact that you speak so highly of Thai cinema. I mean, for myself, the majority of Thai cinema I've seen has been things like the Tony Jaa movies, so things like Ong Bak and Chocolate.
Yep.
So this is kind of unusual, because I mean, this is obviously what do you class this as? I mean, this is a action film, it's a romantic melodrama, it's probably the most fabulous Western ever made.
It's somewhere between affectionate pastiche homage and art house film, I think. It sits in both camps. It's incredibly camp, and at the same time, it's a love letter to a cinema that Thai people no longer know about or appreciate. I'm not wanting to give the history lesson because I'm not necessarily the most qualified person, but Thai cinema has quite a strong history, as does the cinema of all of sort of the sort. Can we call it Indochina, sort of Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia? But Thailand's had a bit more of a stable political world, whereas the other two countries have lost a lot of their older films. The older films from the sort of the 50s, 60s, 70s still exist, but younger people today aren't interested in them. They're interested in the latest Tony Jaa film. They're interested in TV dramas. They're interested in the horror films. So what our friend Wissett has put together here, he comes from screenwriting and advertising background. And so I think this is his first film, isn't it?
Yeah, this is his first film.
Feature. And he's gone back and he's tried to recreate a style of film that was very much prevalent in the 60s and 70s, and that was basically aping Western cinema, and in particular Westerns. And it's, like I say, it's viewed kind of, it's not viewed critically internally, but it's viewed as, oh, they're old, they're rubbish, we don't like that, we like new stuff. So it was just nice to see a new director totally touch base with the past and try and get his local audience aware of what's going on. The sad thing is, it got picked up as an international movie. It went to Cannes, so I think it was the first Thai film to be up in competition in Cannes. And guess who got hold of it? Yes, Harvey Weinstein and the Miramax Corporation. Oh. And again, it's something we'll probably talk about other times for other Asian films. He got hold of it because it critically reviewed quite well at Cannes. Got hold of it, but thought, oh, it's a little bit long because it's, you know, like 97 minutes and the ending's a bit sad. So we'll recut it and we'll shorten it a little bit and we'll save it for the American audience. Well, what happened was test screenings, it went miserably. So then it went into the Miramax vaults for about 5 years, at which point this kind of story comes up around it. You know, it's one of those cult films that no one can get hold of anymore. So amongst sort of Asian film buffs, it becomes one of those sort of holy grails. And there were versions you could get, versions you could import, but actually some of them were cut even worse. I've heard of a one with 30 minutes cut out of it, which,
oh god,
I can only imagine cuts out all the melodrama bits and just sort of sells it as some kind of wacky Western. So I think it took another 5 or 6 years before somebody else got it out. It's got released on DVD, so it's available here in the UK. You got hold of a copy fairly easily, I imagine. Yeah. It's not a fantastic DVD release. It's a bit bare bones, but at least it's out there. At least it got rescued from the same place that Snowpiercer's currently still languishing in.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the problem. I mean, Miramax, obviously, their basis, one of their business models has always been like independent and foreign cinema. That's what they always based it off. So it didn't surprise me the fact that the Weinsteins bought it. Much like the fact that it didn't surprise me the fact that old Harvey Scissorhands decided to start cutting bits out of it. And they cut out some really random scenes. I mean, they cut out whole characters such as the character Sergeant Yam, who's like this comic relief character. There was like one of the characters in Engagement was cut out as well. And I love the fact that when Harvey Weinstein goes and messes around with like a sad ending, it's always because 9/11.
Indeed, yeah, and it's always the.
And it's like because after he's quoted saying that that after 9/11 nobody would want to see something sad, and it's sort of like, what gives you the right to go and cut someone else's film? You're handling the distribution. You aren't the producer who you would imagine would have the right to cut someone's film. Because obviously, you know, they're investing money in the film being released. But as the distribution side, what right do you really have to go and edit someone else's film? And I mean, as you rightfully said, I mean, it sat in the vault till 2006, where Magnolia Pictures picked up the distribution rights. And I mean, the original cut is 101 minutes. I think the version we watched is around 91. So it's a little bit shorter, the one we saw, but it's still. It's still a decent cut that we have that's available through Magnolia Pictures. But as you rightly said, assuming it's a very bare-bones release. There's no special features. And I think on the DVD copy I've got, that they actually market chapter selection as a special feature.
They do indeed. And the trailer, it looks like it's been recorded via a cam at a cinema. it doesn't display the sort of the visual style at all. But yeah. Which is a shame. I have real mixed feelings about Miramax and Harvey Weinstein in particular, because yes, there's all that. There's everything we've just spoken about, yeah, about grabbing movies, hiding them in the vault, butchering them, blah blah blah. But at the same time, it's an American studio that is going out there to those different territories and pulling movies into a Western, make them at least available to a Western mainstream audience. Yeah. So it's done in such a terrible way on so many occasions.
Oh, definitely so. And I mean, this is, let's not forget, this is what led to the death of Tartan, because Tartan was unable to get those key releases. And it was really pinpointed down to the fact that they were unable to get the rights to The Host, that sort of marked the beginning of the end for Tartan. That's what a lot of people cited as what sort of led, and the fact that they started off as the only company really bringing in sort of like the new wave of Asian cinema, with things as we've certainly mentioned before when we talked about the new Asian invasion, when they were bringing in films like The Ring and Battle Royale and Takashi Miike's Audition. And it, basically, a lot of other companies, and certainly a lot of lesser companies, were seeing this as like, oh, an easy way to cash in. So they were basically going and trying to buy up the same films that Tartan was obviously bringing across. And it sadly led to their demise. And I'm still frustrated even now, the fact that we still don't get as nice a release as we get with Tartan. We perhaps come close with the likes of Arrow, but Arrow have got this really annoying habit of doing these really hand-drawn and like, Neil Grindhouse covers and all their DVDs, which is a little frustrating. And you mentioned already Snowpiercer. Do you think we're ever going to see a release of Snowpiercer over here in the UK?
Well, maybe, because Bong has got a new movie about to come out, hasn't he? The one that's on Netflix, that's produced by Netflix, and there's all the fuss about it at Cam. So I guess with another Bong movie around, there might be an opportunity for it to come out. I'm lucky. I saw it when I was in Hong Kong. I saw it when it came out, and it's a perfectly good, fine, if not really good movie. Yeah. And it just seems bizarre that it's not done the rounds in the UK.
Oh, I guess now I know what the Americans feel like for having not been able to get out of a copy of Battle Royale or The Boys Love Mandy Lane for so long. Because I think that's the only real comparison. But they're still amazed the fact that we don't have Snowpiercer over here. And the fact that it was on Netflix US for like so long. So if you had a copy of like, had something to remove your geo restrictions, you could have obviously watched it that way. But no, at the moment, it's not looking like it's going to happen anytime soon.
No, I don't expect it's on anybody's radar, other than, like I say, unless there's some interest in the film. I can't remember its name, of Okpar or something like that. Yeah, so I'm interested, because I'd seen it before. I'm guessing you were new to it. How did... What struck you about this film?
Well, as I said already, this is probably the most fabulous Western you're ever going to watch. I actually watched part of this with my wife, and she did actually question if this was a gay Western, because it's shot in such bright colours. We've got these very pretty actors here. I mean, the film itself, for those not obviously familiar with it, it follows this working class outlaw named Dumb, who's involved with the daughter of a provisional governor known Rumpoy. And the film basically flashes back and forth over from both modern day to the past, and we obviously see how this couple first met each other and how they reunited later in life before obviously arranging to marry in secret. And it's combines this elements of a love story with obviously the usual Western shenanigans. And it was so interesting to obviously see this film, because it starts off as kind of like a satire of Westerns. The fact that we obviously have Dumb goes in and he's with this other gunman named Mashuan. And they go in and they do this epic, like John Woo style shootout where they're shooting six shooters, but no one ever reloads. And Dumb's there, supposed to be like this amazing gunman, and the fact he does this amazing trick shot. And the film stops, comes up with the title card, "Let's see that again," and shows you how this trick shot was done in slow motion. I thought, wow, this is going to be like a real humorous satire. And then it just goes into this whole love story angle, and it constantly hops around the genres. Well, given this very unique vision of what the director believes a Western should be. As with the other Eastern Westerns we've seen, it doesn't, in many ways, it sticks to like the conventions of what the American and the spaghetti Westerns were, and at the same time brings a lot of Asian flavor to proceedings, as certainly is the case here.
Yeah, for me, it's a film of three acts, as so many films are. You have that sort of opening bit, which is full of imagination and fun and craziness, and absolutely the bit where the film stops and they re-describe the did you just catch that, let's watch it again bit. You know, it's wonderful, but the film doesn't continue that on. But you know, it sets everything up, and you think and it's in this glorious pink and turquoise, isn't it?
Yes.
And they went along, you know, they, and if you ever go to Thailand, that will remind you absolutely, because it's a Buddhist country, there's always little offerings of pink flowers all over the place, and it just seems absolutely right. And when you sort of read about how they made the film, they sort of painted everything pink and turquoise and transferred it to Betamax and back to film to get the right saturation. So visually it's stunning, and in fact I wonder if there could ever be like a Blu-ray version of it to get it even more stunningly shot. And then you have the middle section, which is a very chaste, structured, slow burn romance variation. It feels like many a Korean drama where these two people sort of very slowly fall in love, and convention, societal conventions, stop them really expressing it for each other. So you don't get any rumpy pumpy here. You get looks and maybe the odd touch. And society's definitely getting in the way. You know, poor Dom can't ever be with this girl, because she's of a much higher class and he feels difficult. And then every time they do get close, he messes up and he gets beaten up or something like that for it. So he's trying to stay clear. And then we have the final act where we have one of the craziest attacks on a mansion I've ever seen, including grenade throwing dwarfs, rocket launchers, and then the sort of the kind of sad downbeat ending, doesn't it? But it's definitely film of three acts, and I think a lot of people were blown away by the first act, and then when it got to the more standard structured Asian romance, probably got turned off it a bit, which is a shame because the end then is equally as crazy as the opening.
Before we obviously get into the action side, I just wanted to just talk a minute about the romance angle between Dum and Rompuy. I mean, the first time we're introduced really to this couple and their first meeting as children, when Rompuy first meets Dum, her first introduction is to grab his flute and break it. I mean, they've not said two words, and the fact she just walks up and breaks his flute, I mean, that's a real how do you do, isn't it? So
yeah, she's quite an entitled little rich girl, isn't she? She gets a bit stressed about the fact that he's playing it pretty cool. But of course, that feeds into how she replaces it with the harmonica, which becomes sort of a symbol of their love throughout the rest of the film.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And again, just the tip for tat there. I mean, he breaks the flute, which makes a very lovely noise, very traditional instrument, and then gives him the harmonica, the instrument you play when you can't play an instrument. You might have given him a triangle as a replacement. It's sort of like, really? That you think he's going to appreciate a harmonica when he had a flute before? But it really took me by surprise. He just walks up and breaks the flute. And I was like, wow, that's not really how you talk to someone when you first meet them. Just go up and break their instruments. So
yeah, we could probably go a bit further into what the flute might be representative of. But yes, I just like to see it just shows you what little cow bag she is, really.
Yeah.
But you mentioned them, so we flash back to when they're children. Did you notice how the child actors really look like child versions of the grown-ups, which is something really rare I find in films? Usually when you flash back, you have to be given quite a lot of clues that these are the people that you've already met in the present day.
Yeah.
And not only the two actors, the younger actors, but there's this group of three ruffians that cause them some grief on a rowboat, and then about 10 years later cause them some grief at college as well. It's meant to be the same. But again, they look like child versions of the grown-ups. It's quite remarkable. I don't think I've ever seen a film so consistent in its approach
to
how people look.
These are some absolutely fantastic cast in there. The whole relationship, though, it just seems to consist of Dum coming off the worst. Like, you would have thought that after this first meeting with Rompuy that, you know, he'd perhaps wise up and think, you know, this girl's absolutely no good, because not only does she break his flute, he gets beaten up by the local gang of ruffians.
And gets a scar, a permanent scar for the rest of his life in his forehead for his troubles.
Yeah. He then rescues Rompuy from being half drowned, and his reward for, you know, this noble action is to be beaten by his father with a whip.
Publicly tied to a stake and publicly whipped to within an inch of his life.
And you know, his only thanks for this is the fact that he gets his flute replaced by a harmonica. Okay, we then flash forward to them and the university, and again he faces the same group of ruffians and gets pretty much beaten up again. But for some reason, he, despite all his efforts to distance himself from Rompuy, the two keep coming back together. I mean, do you think it was really worth all the hassle he goes through for this woman?
Well, obviously not. When we know what happens in the end, I think the poor fella gets the rough end of the rough end of the stick the whole way through, really. But again, it's a very Asian thing. It's a very this codified, structured, almost chaste romance where the guy goes through anything for the girl. I mean, it stops short of him giving her a piggyback somewhere, which is the other or giving her his umbrella, which are the other, which are the two things you'll always see in Asian melodramas and romances. But yeah, I wouldn't have bothered. She was a pretty girl, but after the second beating, I might have given up.
I mean, there was the trouble I have with Asian cinema, and this was certainly the case with Ong Bak, is that some of the accents can be a little grating. So I was kind of glad that, because we're obviously watching this, it's in its original dialogue and it's subtitled. So I was kind of glad that the accents weren't particularly grating in this one. Because if I had to obviously sit through another round of listening to, if we've run probably sounded anything like the girlfriend in Ong Bak, I would have pretty much ended it a lot earlier.
This one wasn't so bad, but there is something you have to watch with Thai movies. Is that obviously, as we've as the thing we're skirting around is we can't say any of their names because they have very long names, multi-syllabled names. So they all have shortened versions of the names. And quite often, when you listen to a very talk-heavy Thai movie, they'll mention the name in every sentence. So I think it's just the way the language works. You know, you say the name of the subject, so there'll be ah dam da 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 dam da da dam, and it just go on and on, and it gets really quite the it really does. It's quite a lovely language on the whole, but sometimes in film it gets quite grating because it's very dialogue heavy, and you'll just pick up on that one word that you know, and it's said in a really, to a Western ear, quite frustrating way. But this one wasn't too bad. In fact, I was sort of straining my ears to see, how do you say rumpaye? Because it's a very unusual looking word. And so I like to, you know, learn a bit of language out of it anyway.
Yeah, it's always good. You know, teach yourself a new language by watching foreign cinema.
Yeah, that's always the plan. Never quite goes that way, does it? Or you learn terrible words.
No. I'm always told that my pronunciation is just horrible. So, whenever you try to like use a bit of Japanese or whatever word you've picked up, and they just look at you that look of pity, it's sort of like, oh, he's trying, isn't that nice?
Yeah, but most I've got Chinese friends who just look at me and just absolutely think don't bother, just don't bother.
One of the main selling points of this film, and certainly if I was to sell this film, it would be on the action scenes. These action scenes are so over the top, which I think is putting it mildly. They've got like this John Woo Ringo Lam style flamboyance to them. Yet at the same time, they're just completely over the top. It's sort of like, it's almost as though the director's like gone, okay, John Woo would go to this point. Let's go past it. As seen, well, we have this shootout between this group of outlaws and the police, and we've got Dumb basically shows up with this other bandit, and they break out a pair of rocket launchers to start shooting at the police. And I lost count of the amount of bullets that were fired in this one scene. It just seems like everyone has unlimited ammunition in this film.
Well, yeah, and of course with the old six shooter seems to all be able to shoot like at least 12 bullets without reloading, and they have amazing aim, don't they? The smaller the weapon, the better the aim, sort of thing. But there's a sort of a kind of joyous, who gives a fuck about the whole thing? it just bullets fly, people shoot. There's one point later on in the film where one bullet is shot and three people fly backwards as if they've been knocked over by a hurricane. And there's the bit in the scene that you're talking about, the first sort of rocket launcher comes in, the main bad guy, is standing there, and then an arm just falls down next to him, and he sort of gives it this look like, oh well, and just carries on. They're just rolling with the fun of it, I think. But at the same time, you'll see a lot of, with all the outrageous stuff, it's very influenced by spaghetti western, in particular Sergio Leone, with all the close-ups and sometimes even the music cues. There are definitely music cues stolen from the Once Upon a Time in the West and so on. But, you know, they do like the full eye close-up and then sometimes the long pull away. So it's interesting, but like I say, both camp and then utterly respectful to what was gone before as well at the same time.
Yeah, and it's unusual the fact that we've obviously got these elements of romance combined with really like a Peckinpah style Western. I mean, it's very, kept bringing back memories of like watching The Wild Bunch in particular. The fact that you see bullets hit people and you see brains being blown out, and It's a very bloody and violent Western when we have the shootout sequences.
It's very visceral, isn't it?
Yeah. For that, I really enjoyed it, but it's like you're trying to appeal to two very different audiences. We've obviously drawn people in who are attracted to this very cinematic style. We've got this very colourful palette that it's being shot under. We've got all this sort of like these doomed lovers that plot in their romance, and at the same time we're contrasting it with these full-blown shootouts and all this violence and brains and limbs being flying everywhere. And it's sort of like, how would you even which group do you appeal to when recommending this film? I mean, do you like sell this as like to sort of like the action fans, or do you sell this to people who like romance? It's like it sort of fails both crowds in one way or another.
I think it does. So I think you just sell it as a cult film, which is a kind of catch-all for everything, isn't it? But I you know, again, I've read a lot of reviews of this, and almost universally people like the action stuff, people like the visual style, and they find the romance on the whole, it's stalling, isn't it? It just knocks the impetus of the movie dead.
Yeah.
And even more so because it kind of repeats itself. So I'd hate to think that I'm being Harvey Weinstein here, but I can see a good reason for cutting out half the romance stuff. I think that would probably make the movie flow a little better, and you'd still get the right idea. But yes, I think you just sell it under cult, and it's not one for your pure actioners. It's certainly not people who like their melodrama or their doomed romances. It's somewhere in between, and I think you treat it like a lovely crazy painting rather than a deep movie.
It's certainly an oddity. I'm just really trying to remember a time when I've seen a film this sort of random or genre bending. Really, I mean. Obviously, that brings to mind things such as like Save the Green Planet, which obviously had its own genre hopping antics. I'm trying to remember the film.
I mean, I guess in Korean cinema, you get quite a lot of this. You get a film that starts off as one thing and ends up as another. What's unusual here, it starts off as one thing, comes something else, then goes back to what it was before. But in Korean cinema, you're quite a lot. You'll start off as a wacky comedy and then suddenly turn into a Cancer Girl movie, or it'll start as an action and end up as a romance. And that's not, you'll get used to that watching a lot of Korean cinema. But it's its own thing, and then when you take the director's work as a whole, you'll see he's very interested in the crazy and the outlandish, but also utterly utterly interested in the style and the visual feel. And this feels like someone's first movie, doesn't it? It almost feels like someone's film school project, you know, where they're drawing upon a bunch of influences. And it doesn't quite, I mean, I love the film, but it doesn't quite work. And that's why I recommended it, because I thought I was really kind of interested. But someone like you, who knows this cult cinema, who's tried many things, what they thought of it. And I guess if you were going to say to anybody, I guess it's some Takashi Miike you could draw some parallels to.
Oh, yeah, I feel that. I mean, if we were just going for the most obvious comparison, I mean, we could obviously compare it to his own Shinjuku Western Django. Obviously, Miike there doing his own unique take on what the Western would be. But no, I mean, certainly, Miike, if we certainly look at films from like the outlaw period, certainly we would see examples of this. It's so hard when you obviously bring Miike though, and certainly films the outlaw period, because it's sort of like, well, he's slightly more extreme and certainly less subtle in the romance elements than we obviously see with this film. Perhaps something like Rainy Dog would be the film that I would obviously most compare to this. It's got that sort of elements of action and whimsy to it. Certainly enjoyed this. I love the fact that there's a dwarf gunslinger.
I think that's everybody's favourite, and everyone's very sad when he gets killed.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler, yeah, indeed. But I think we're past spoiler alerts at this point.
It's...
Yeah.
Oh. I mean, is there anything else about this film that that you want to discuss. I mean, as you said, it's very much a film of two very different, very conflicting styles that are somehow glued together to create this very unique experience. And at the same time, we've got a director who's obviously not afraid to throw in a little visual whimsy as well. I enjoyed the film throughout. I thought there was some great performance throughout. Certainly our leading man, Chachai Nangsun, who plays Dum Dwai, has got some fantastic cheekbones. As my
he
wife,
has, and as she told you, right? But yeah, he's. I mean, he's a. I mean, he hasn't had much of a career since, but he was. He's like a television model, adverts kind of person, you know. Yeah. So he's got great cheekbones, good looking fella, and actually. Our female lead, I can't remember her name. What's her name? Stella something, or the very English sounding name she's got. Yeah, Stella, or her English stroke Spanish, Italian. So Stella Malucci. They do a lot of things with her, and I think, I could be wrong, but I think they're sort of harking back. It's a very famous Thai actress from the 60s and 70s called Petchara Chowarat, who is a very elegant, big-eyed lady, but it's what she wears, and the hair, the very stylized hair. She may have noticed that Rumpoye has, her hair is always fantastic, and it's always full of amazing curves and molded into fantastic ways. That's very much what Petchara's look was. So she'd be very famous. So a lot of people would have recognized that in there. So again, it's very respectful to a certain age of Thai cinema, which is actually quite frowned upon because people think it was very influenced by the West. So again, there's this care in every element. The sad thing is, I don't think most of the audience, not only the Thai people, but us ignorant Westerners, probably didn't get half of it either.
Well, it's mainly, I mean, we've got nothing to really compare it to. I mean, obviously the director himself has gone record, he said that most Thai audiences, they dislike Thai movies, especially like old ones, which they consider to be Nam Nob, which translates as stinky water.
Yeah, they don't like the things from the past, which is a shame.
Yeah, it just obviously gives us the fact that Thai cinema obviously hasn't had the same popularity as the likes of, like, when we look at like Hong Kong or Japanese or even Korean cinema, because we don't have the reference points. It's so hard to see where he's obviously coming from and the reference points for this. And the only thing we can really do is to compare it to like American counterparts, or in our case, obviously to like the Japanese counterparts of things that we've seen before. So it's certainly unique in that point, and it's, if you like Eastern Westerns, this is definitely another one worth seeing. Want to put along the likes of Shinjuku Western Django or The Good, the Bad, and the Weird. I mean, have you seen any of the director's other films at all? Or is this?
Well, I have. One? I have, and I'm going to save it because at the end when we recommend another movie,
okay,
it's going to be one of his. Cool. But he has. But yeah, I've seen most of his other stuff. So very visual director, very interested in visual style. The film he followed this up with is probably his biggest success, is one called Citizen Dog, which I guess you would compare to something like the French film Amelie, which is a very visual, full of visual jokes and cues and things like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, he's a visual guy, but he hasn't got a huge look. A lot of these directors seem to create hundreds of films, but he's never been that prolific.
We're going to take a quick break, though, but when we return, we will be looking at our further viewing and the films which we have chosen to pair with Tears of the Black Tiger.
Why haven't you seen Jaws?
I've seen Finding Nemo. That's close enough, right?
Why haven't you seen The Usual Suspects?
Because I already know who Kaiser Soze is.
I can't believe you haven't seen Videodrome.
What? Has anyone seen Videodrome?
You haven't seen Psycho.
Okay. How about I start a podcast where someone will introduce me to one of these great movies I've never seen before, and in return, I'll have them watch a superhero movie. Film-wise, the Why Haven't You Seen This Film podcast. Find it on iTunes or Stitcher Radio.
And we're back. Obviously, still joining me is Stephen Palmer.
Hello, I'm still here.
And we were obviously in the first half, we were talking about Tears of Black Tiger. We're now going on to our further viewing. So this is the section of the show where we both give a selection to pair with, obviously, our main selection of the evening. So, Stephen, obviously, this was your selection this month. So you chose Tears of Black Tiger. What would you like to pair with it?
Okay, so I'm going to go for another one of Wisit Sasantieng's films, and it's called The Unseeable. Now, The Unseeable is, not only is it matching, it's matching because it's another one of his films, but I also mentioned at the beginning that they're really good at, Thai films are really good at horror movies, and very, and specifically ghost stories. So The Unseeable is a period ghost story set in Thailand. And although it doesn't have the gaudy colouring of Tears of the Black Tiger, it's a much more sepia toned piece, but it's a beautifully filmed and constructed, and sometimes I think there's nothing better than watching an Asian film set in sort of like the 1920s, where you have this early influx of Western visuals. So you can think of films such as well, like The Handmaiden that Park Chan-wook recently did, where there's a real mix of East and West. There's a I think it was called The Silence, a recent Korean film which did that. There's several films of it. Any film set in Shanghai in the 20s or 30s, I'm in love with. But this is a Thai movie. As a ghost story, and if you've seen The Others, you'll pretty much know where it's coming from. But it's just a beautiful looking, fantastic atmosphere, little story. And it shows what someone can do with a little money, with little money, and a great cast and just a good visual style. So I'd highly recommend that. It's really hard, unfortunately, to find the only version of it on DVD I found in the West has got basically the picture is in the middle of about another screen's worth of black bar. It's really weird and it's really hard to watch. If you can find it other ways, I highly recommend it.
For myself, I'm going to be going with a film by Suzuki. I'm going to go with a film by Susan Suzuki, and that is the film from 1967, Branded to Kill. This is, again, a film which combines many different genre elements into probably one of the more unique viewing experiences that I'd had at the time, and certainly until I saw Tears of the Black Tiger. This one, it follows Goro Handa, and he's the Japanese underworld's third-ranked hitman, and he's currently finds himself being hunted by the Phantom Number One Killer. And he's a hitman who's got not only some usual methods, but at the same time, he's got a bit of a fetish for rice, in particular smell. And this is a film which is not only beautifully shot, but features some truly random plot changes, including the two hitmen moving in together at one point, as we get probably one of the more random twists on The Odd Couple. But if you're new to Suzuki's work, then Branded to Kill is an absolutely great starting point along the likes of Tokyo Drifter, and certainly a film that I would recommend watching. And certainly if you enjoy the randomness of Tears of Black Tiger, then I think that Branded to Kill is certainly going to provide you more of the same, at the same time providing a lot of the Japanese sort of Yakuza thrills for those who obviously just like hitman movies as well. So it enables to do something artistic and at the same time provide something with a little grunt behind it as well. But no, Branded to Kill is going to be my selection to pair with Tears of Black Tiger.
And I'd recommend that as well myself. Fantastic movie, which, and the story behind it is almost as interesting as the film itself. So well worth hunting that one down.
Yeah, I have a feeling that we're going to come back to Branded to Kill at some point. Certainly Suzuki's work as a director is one that I'm keen to dive in at some point. So certainly look out for some looks at his work on future episodes of this show. But as for tonight's show, we now bring things to a close. And on the next edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club, we are going to be looking at a film which has been proclaimed by Quentin Tarantino as being one of his favourites, and is also one of the films I'm kind of a shame that I've never actually watched, as we're going to be looking at Wong Kar-wai's 1994 film, Chungking Express, a film which I know, Stephen, you're a big fan of.
I'm not just a big fan of it, it's probably my favourite Asian movie of all time, so I am delighted you've picked that, and it's taken one on my side of the list.
Okay. Obviously, so that's coming up on the next episode. Obviously, in the meantime, Stephen, if people want to find you, where's the best place to come and find you?
Yeah, you can come and find me on my blog at guelorambling.wordpress.com, or come and see the more group effort at easternkicks.com, where there's always news, reviews, interviews about Asian cinema going on, new posts every day. And if you want to get hold of me, you can get my email at thingsfallapart@hotmail.co.uk, or you can get me on Twitter on @LPVO.
Okay. We have also set up a Letterboxd list. You can find the link in the description below, which not only features all the films we've covered on the show already, but our recommendations as well. So you can go and follow that on Letterboxd. If you wish to follow my own blog, it's From the Depths of DVD Hell, which is fromthedepthsofdvdhell.blogspot.co.uk, and the Twitter is @Elwood_Jones. Coming up on the next edition of the Mad, Bad and Downright Strange Showcase, though, we are celebrating 50 episodes of the Mad, Bad and Downright Strange Showcase by holding our second draft. This time it is a Deadpool draft, so we will be looking at our favourite movie deaths and the many moods which movie deaths can take. So that's obviously coming up on the next episode. But until then, I'd like to say thank you to my co-host Stephen, as always.
Thank you very much for having me, as ever.
And this is Elwood Jones signing off for another edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club, reminding you, as always, to keep it strange. Hey! 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 昨日の恋は忘れて 昨日のあの子は忘れて 踊り続けていたい 夜なのさ 月が砕け散っても 星が燃えて落ちても 踊り続けていたい 夜なのさ 胸に刺さった 恋の刃が 燃える思いを わすのさ昨日の恋は忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ